All right, everybody, welcome back to Drat and Drake Veterinary Podcast. Let's see. Today, we have a guest named Dr. Taylor Austin. She is someone that I've come to know after the last couple of years, or a few years at this point. She's got a really cool story, not just from like upbringing of background, but just her veterinary journey has been very unique and I think is definitely worth a listen for people who are either entering into the ER field or just in vet school in general, because she's brilliant, hardworking, and a combination of these two has, again, created a wonderful story. So everyone, welcome Dr. Taylor Austin.
Thank you, Dan. That's awesome. Yeah, we definitely do go way back, and it's so nice to connect at this point in like my career with you, because you did know me like while I was becoming a baby doctor in vet school,
and yeah,
I got to kind of see you as like a new grad, and you know, here we are, me in like my coming up to the first year of being, you know, a vet now, and you already, you know, getting your notches in your belt. And so it's been really cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's hopefully you were able to, I mean, I guess a little more background is just as I was entering ER in Florida, I mm-hmm. believe you just left for vet school. So I actually didn't meet you until I think your first summer off when you worked in the yeah. summertime as a tech, yeah. right? And hopefully you were able to visualize and learn from my mistakes, which helped build where you are now. So you went to U of F for vet school, correct?
Yeah. So I guess like if we back it all the way, you know, before that, I was always interested in medicine. And I think I didn't know if I was going to go into the human medicine route or vet med route, and then became a veterinary technician. And that kind of just solidified that was going to be the road for me. And then I moved to Palm Beach, where I did emergency medicine for the first time. Was a little bit nervous because I didn't know how I was going to handle the realm of what emergency is. I feel like when you go into it for the first time, you think you're either going to like sink or swim.
Yeah.
And I definitely think I swam. I loved it. And that's where, you know, we worked at the same hospital that I left to go to vet school and then came back to do some time while I was in vet school and, you know, connected with you. And then, yeah, got accepted to University of Florida, did my 4 years there, kept working as an emergency tech during my studies. So I was working part-time, studying, and then doing clinics. And it was definitely crazy. A lot of ECC. I tried to fall in love with anything else because obviously there's, you know, the darker side to emergency medicine of how it's sustainable. And unfortunately, nothing really took. So found myself really pursuing ER after.
Okay, nice. Now, how many years of GP nursing did you do before you jumped into ER?
I did about a year and a half. It was actually a small little clinic in South Florida that I had a connection with growing up. My mother used to work as a receptionist there. So when I came back to finish up some schooling, I connected with them, and they had let me always do like little assistant jobs growing up, cuddling the dogs after like operations. And so now that I was, you know, older and in a more professional setting, they sort of gave me my foot in their door to train to become a tech. And so that's where I learned all my like baseline skills, and then just took it one step further into ER after a year or so.
Okay, nice. What were some of the biggest, as a nurse, for nursing skills, what were some of the biggest jumps in skill set that you've noticed?
From like going from GP to ER,
mm-hmm.
gosh, it was huge. It was a very different approach, I think, especially when you come from like being the triage nurse, and then it was just the breadth of like cases that you see when you're working GP. Often it's, you know, annual well visits most of the time, or your generic ADR, right? Not doing well, and they're maybe vomiting, not eating. And I think I was a little naive because I didn't know enough to know the breadth of what doctors' minds do when like these things start to like accumulate these clinical signs. And I think my jump into ER, the nurses have a lot more responsibility of recognizing some of these clinical signs and complaints to know what jumps the line, what to do immediately, what to tell the doctor right away, and what could wait. And so that really started to get my wheels turning and be like, you know what, I actually want to take this further and go to vet school and learn everything there is about it.
Well said. Yeah, I think a big part, and of course, you know, this isn't the major focus of the podcast, but I think we talk a lot about mentorship in as a veterinarian, but I think mentorship in just the nursing field is also can be pretty challenging to achieve sometimes. as you were saying, sink or swim, especially in the ER. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Great nurses are very powerful for just a great ER in general. So yeah, definitely commend them. And my role in that definitely, I think, helped me become a really good like ER doctor now as well. So like, I'm always grateful for the experience that I had.
Oh yeah.
Would you say that as far as the crossover between GP and ER, I guess it just made me think how in like human medicine, there seems to be a divergence of boarded ER docs versus in the past, there was a lot of like primary care docs that seemed to do ER from what I'm aware. Do you feel like where things stand in the veterinary world, that it would be a benefit for both, I guess, vets and technicians to do time in ER and GP and like go back and forth? Or do you feel like it would be better to kind of split those into two and have like more dedicated training in each?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's a great question, because I do think that is one of the areas where we do have a lot of overlap. And more we're seeing it diverge, because before you used to have your vet that would, you know, just see everything and almost share his cell phone with his clients, because call me for any emergencies, and they'd be your little town vet doing everything. And now our industry has grown to the point where we not only have ERs and specialty clinics and GPs, we have urgent cares opening up left, right, and center to like meet in the middle. So it's really interesting. And I think there's something to be said on both sides almost, because those emergency skills you develop being an ER doctor, I think, are paramount. Because as a GP, you never know really what's going to walk through the door, and you can always have emergencies in a GP setting. So being like prepared for that makes you, I think, just a better practitioner overall. And then in the ER world, those GP skills of being able to communicate and connect with clients, as well as have that empathy and long-term sort of approach, which we often lose in ER because it is so, you know, acute, they're sick, hopefully we never see you again. I think it makes for skills that are also good in ER. So I don't know. I think there's something to be said for both. I've seen GP doctors balance a life between GP and ER, and then ER doctors that also do a little bit of GP, but mostly ER. And that's kind of what I'm at right now. I love the hustle and bustle of ER. I feel like I'm young enough that I can sustain the lifestyle. So my current lifestyle is actually a lot more ER, and I do occasional GP now.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, you make a good point, because I think the focus is from looking at like on the ER perspective, bringing ER skills to GP and being prepared for situations where they may not have as much exposure. But you're right that I think we don't emphasize enough that there are skills that I think you gain in GP, having repeat clients and being able to really connect with people, that ER struggles with a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it all sounds, and I think I agree. I think the crossover is really beneficial on both sides more than it would benefit from the separation. So it's just,
No, and to just go on that as well, in ER, you have a very finite amount of time to gain a family's trust with their pet, whereas in GP, they've gained that trust over time. And so often am I faced with cases where I've told them, you know, everything that's going on, and then it's like, well, can you call my vet and tell my vet so he can tell me what to do?
Story and, of our lives, huh?
And knowing that, you know, we probably do have more experience, we know what we're talking about, but the trust aspect of being, this is the first time I'm meeting this client and they have a trust, you know, and connection established already with someone. So I think, you know, I've really tried to incorporate that in my practice, and it has helped to just be a little bit more like empathetic and connect with clients in the process of obviously treating their pet.
Yeah, that's so true. So, sorry, Alfred, I know I jumped in on your thing.
No, that was a great question. I just going into more of your personal career story, you're telling me you were doubling down working but also studying and being crazy. You graduated vet school again from University of Florida, and you ended up matching with their emergency internship program, correct?
Yeah. So funny enough, I actually did it outside the match. So you get into your final year of vet school, obviously you're inundated with, what am I going to do next? Do I do internship? Do I do the match? You know, being very focused on wanting to do emergency medicine, there's even the road to take it and become a criticalist and specialize in it. So that also was something I was debating. I had an amazing team of mentors at UF that really took me under their wing. I worked with them a lot because of my position as a technician. So they were all rooting for me and wanting to encourage me to
Oh,
pursue a
nice.
residency. But
Yeah.
that obviously comes with longer education, you know, further sacrifice of the already 8 years of school that you do, and then the financial aspect. And so I had actually accepted an offer at a hospital in Texas pretty early on in my 4th year, and then was really in like this dynamic struggle of like, I don't know if that's the right choice, because that first position outside of vet school, there's so many people that put a lot of pressure on it and tell you that's going to be how you practice medicine. It's your first year out. You need to make sure it has mentorship, and then it guides you in all the different right directions. So I think I shared the stress of everyone trying to find the perfect fit, and then ended up respectfully getting back to that place, telling them that I had changed my mind for a specialty internship in emergency and critical care at UF that had been offered to me outside the match. And so that would let me have time to decide if I wanted to do residency or not, because I was really still debating. And I started the internship, and then along that same line had some personal things happen in my life that made the struggles of schedule and finances during an internship really apparent. So we're working through, obviously, the internship. It was incredible. It was amazing. But my mentors also told me that I probably would be okay leaving the internship if I needed to. And so that's essentially what it came down to. It was an amazing couple months. I left in September. And so the internship started in June, and it was definitely 80 to 90 hours a week, switching from day to swing to overnight. And then we even have a satellite clinic in Ocala at the University of Florida, where the ECC interns go, and you're like left alone there overnight. And so I got thrust into it really early. And being a student at UF and working there, I think the beginning of my internship, there was that lack of anonymity that other interns have. And so because I think they knew what I was capable of, there was a extra level of trust that I think I accelerated past where most interns start. That made leaving a little bit of an easier decision as well, that what I had gained in just a couple of months is probably good enough for me to take a step away from the realms of like an academic intense mentorship position. And I also left because the finances, you know, and the sacrifice in time just wasn't really what I needed in that point of my life. So then I left, and I actually went into relief work. And that's, I think, where the premise of this whole conversation is, because it
yeah.
was a pretty wild decision for me
yeah,
as a
it's
new
unusual.
grad to just
Yeah.
jump into relief work after like 3 months of an internship.
That's a very modest way of saying you killed it in your emergency internship.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if there's like a reason to leave your internship, it's being really good at it. It's, you know, a good reason, but
I mean, I don't want to say that. I think I'm very well aware that I have a lot to learn. I don't know everything. I think the skill that made me feel comfortable leaving, and that maybe it does take people longer to develop, is I have the skill of like almost like assessment risk and like decision making, and saying that like, and that's what you have to do in ER. It's not knowing everything, but it's knowing which decision is going to carry the most and the least risk. And like, and making that choice for like patients.
Also, yeah.
And I got really resourceful with, you know, the things that I didn't know. What did I have time to like call a friend, find resources? What did I have to make a decision? And like, how risky was it if I was wrong or if I was right? And that really, really helped, and kind of just took it with me moving forward.
So, yeah, you moved back down to South Florida, and you immediately started relief shortly after coming back down here in September, correct?
Yeah. So my family's all in South Florida. So then I kind of began the whole, you know, one of the reasons, you know, I wanted to leave was to be closer to family. My brother had just had a beautiful baby, and starting to cultivate the life that I wanted just became a lot more of a priority than doing the grind of internship, maybe residency, because it just wasn't lining up with my like full goal. And so I moved back down south and was starting to reach out to all these hospitals as a relief doctor. And I think what really made it work for me was three components to it, is that I reached out to do relief work with a very honest approach, and some boundaries that I needed to make sure that I wasn't getting myself into, you know, an unsafe position for patients as well as myself, that I was very honest and said, I'm a new grad. This is my level of comfort with these things. I'm resourceful, but I want to work relief shifts where I have overlap with people, and I am looking for a full-time job. So this is my way of trying to find the hospital that fits. And so I think with that sort of honest approach, and the industry also being in a place where they're really looking for ER doctors, it just worked everywhere that I went.
Yeah.
Do you have any other specific boundaries that you're happy to list?
Yeah, I think definitely when working overlap with people in the beginning was a big thing. I didn't work night shifts because most of those, they want you to work alone, but I definitely would work late swings. I think those are the two big ones that I can think of
which are
right
important.
Now. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, those are the two big ones.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. Yeah, which honestly, I feel like the whole paradigm of working relief and then finding a permanent position seems to be more common lately. And I think honestly, it kind of is a better way to do things, right? Because I feel like from the hospital's perspective, you kind of don't know who you're getting, right? They can interview well, but they may actually be a pretty kind of bummer doctor long term. Mm-hmm. And on the flip side, if you're reliefing, you know, you can kind of already get a taste of how's the team work together? How are the clients here? You know, so I think, I don't know, I think it's a good model for the future, but
it was fantastic for me. And that's, I think, why this is such an interesting way, because it's not the easiest position though to be in as a new grad, to find your perfect unicorn hospital, because of the expectations of what a relief doctor is. And I think I had a benefit that I came out really prepared for some of those expectations that a relief doctor has, and then also kind of cushioned it with being very honest to the employers that were hiring me as a relief doctor, these are my capabilities and this is not what I'm not willing to do because I don't have enough skill, and are you okay with this? And most of the time everyone was like, absolutely, that's fine. And I think the fact that I was also looking for a full-time position made them more willing to bring me on, so that they had time to get to know me as well as I had time to get to know the hospital. And you know, I did. I found my unicorn hospital. Yeah. So it's been great.
We'll get into that. So what are the values for you? So what you had, you know, I wouldn't, you know, there is almost essentially a luxury of being able to, at this, the way the market is, to be able to kind of pick and choose which hospital is a good fit for you. What qualities in a hospital, in an ER hospital, it makes it for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think a super important one for people that end up listening to this that are in a similar position that I was, like new grads, to really consider, because you do come out and you're inundated with these contracts and offers that some are too good to be true, and monetarily, even schedule and brand new shiny hospitals and equipment, without maybe seeing the value that is less obvious on black and white paper, which is the people you're working with and the environment that is portrayed, you know, in that hospital and the culture. I never went into this career expecting it to be perfect, and that's not what I was looking for, because I do know when you are working with people, not people are different and they're going to hold different opinions, and you don't necessarily need to be best friends with everyone you work with. But I wanted to work in a hospital where I could keep growing, because obviously I'm a new grad. I want to learn the best. I want to learn from the best and know that I'm continually growing in my skills and my knowledge for my patients, and I'm doing best practice medicine.
Absolutely.
But also I really was trying to find a collaborative, welcoming culture. I think I'm not just speaking for myself, where this culture of veterinary medicine has become really critical between colleagues in some situations, maybe more so on the ER side, especially with relief doctors. In some ways, we all practice different. We come from different mentorships, internships and schools, and medicine changes quickly, where there are some people that are practicing old ways new people that are practicing new ways, those with less their experience coming in doing the best they can, while almost being judged by those that do it differently. And I think it's to no one's fault in a sense. And if we just were more collaborative and like extended a hand instead of a criticism, we'd be in a different place. And I was really trying to find a place that I could feel like I didn't know anything, like everything, and like grow and not feel judged for like where I was lacking. And while that was like in my head, I'm like, I'm never going to find that. It was nice because I did find the team of people that do share that kind of mentality, and it's been great. And other places are worse than others, but I think it's just about knowing what's important to you in the phase of your career. And once you get comfortable, maybe money is the biggest factor. For me, being like newer and really trying to establish like how I was going to practice medicine, the mentorship and the place was really important, because I also want to be happy going to work every day.
Of course.
So even if I practice great medicine with amazing mentorship, but they made me miserable and cry every night, I didn't want to do that.
There's a balance.
Which is a lot of internships out there.
So it sounds like you're like the people you work with, in from your perspective, are like one of the most critical things as far as like early on versus necessarily like the prestige of the program, kind of the level of advanced medicine that you're working with. Would you say like prioritize the personalities of who you're working with is kind of the big thing that people should value?
Teaching personality, because obviously depending on the degree of medicine you're trying to get to, whether it's just GP, ER, specialty medicine, or eventual training to be that like in a residency program, you do have to make sure you are getting that experience. So with that maybe comes less options to prioritize, like, you know, working with your best friends. But I think there are people that are better at teaching that don't make you feel stupid all the time, for lack of better words. And there are some people that are really, really good mentors that then kind of teach you how you want to teach. And it's kind of like that ripple effect, because if you're treated a certain way during internship or during the first couple of years, then someone else is going to come along in a couple of years and you're going to treat them the same way. So it's just been nice to know that there is a model out there of teaching and being in a collaborative group that works without pulling people down in the process.
Yeah. I have a question that I don't really think there's a direct answer to, but I'm curious to know your thought on this. You know, you mentioned that there are people who are very judgmental in hospitals, ER hospitals particularly. Do you think this kind of personality, and of course we have colleagues that we've worked with together who we can probably quickly name, but do you think those personalities come from the actual internal person themselves, or is it based on external factors such as, one, maybe the way they were mentored from their mentor, or even just the way the hospital is with their culture? So for example, if we know someone who is very judgmental at one hospital, but they're put in a much more positive environment, do you think that they would be a better person to work with in that environment?
Ooh, now we get into like the psychology of things.
Yeah.
I don't know. I wish I knew, because then maybe we could just make it happen everywhere. But I think it is very independent to like a person. I think I work with some people that are very pleasant, and then others that certainly they are judgmental, and whether that's because of a personal experience that they've had and now they just are bringing it into their life, I do think it's just the individual, because I certainly have been mentored by people that I've gained a lot of wisdom from, but also a lot of criticism from, and like crappy feelings that I'm like, I hear what you're going to say, I don't want to be like you. So next, you know. And so I think it's just a decision to be a better like role model that you have to make for yourself. And some people choose to just do what they want to do and have little disregard for how it affects others potentially, which if they're brilliant and amazing and do patient care, maybe that's where it lacks.
Okay.
What are your thoughts on, I guess, trying to improve things? Because I've definitely seen the critical culture that you described, and it's like, where do we kind of put pressure on things to improve?
Yeah, I think it starts with leadership. I really do believe that. I think it starts with leadership, and it starts with getting the right people in the majority, right? So we're not going to be able to have a perfect system. The bigger the hospital, the more people you need to bring in, and you have less, I think, choice about personality mending versus skill and need. So that's where it probably can get complicated. So leadership, I think, is a big place where just establishing the culture and having those, you know, no-goes and easily getting rid of the people that you're realizing are not contributing and actually maybe facilitating a downward spiral of the
right.
culture, and being okay with losing that for the sake of the team and the whole, because bad cultures in hospitals can lead to like mass exodus. I've seen it, you know.
Oh,
I think
yeah.
We both have seen it.
And, oh yeah.
So sometimes just taking your time to build slowly with the right people that have the same mindset is going to be, I think, the way to go. It's slower, it's harder probably, but
better in the long
term. I don't have a
yeah.
very great alternative option.
Sure. That's a $1 million question for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, following up with my previous one about kind of the judgmental aspect of it, for advice for newer graduates, right, or just people
yeah.
struggling to accept or trying to put themselves in a situation where they can better themselves medically, do you have any advice for them on how they can receive criticism from these types of, you know, more judgmental mentors or doctors?
Yeah, that's a good one, because I mean, I think we've all been there, and I certainly have not been perfect and have had to take advice as well as feedback. And I think just always leading with respect and like learning to not take things personally. And if you do feel personally attacked, to like build up the confidence to stand up for yourself. I think there's a lot of those seniority name tags, letters behind names that almost make people feel like they're untouchable as well as unapproachable. But I definitely have spoken up when I feel like something has been wrong, or even when I've been told that I was wrong, where I was like, can we talk about this more? And I ask why a lot. I ask why, instead of just being told to do this. I remember that was like the biggest thing, is I don't just want to be told we do this because we do this. This is the way we've always done it. I really want to know why. And if they can't have a good enough reason, then maybe we need to explore that more. And just having that standard that you treat yourself with respect just as much as others. And I think that just allows for an equal playing field, because that's just the approach that I've had. And it's really, really uncomfortable sometimes to like go into confrontation with adults. But in the end, I think it's always led to a better relationship. And funny enough, I've had doctors that I've worked with that have had like a notorious reputation for being mean or blunt and disrespectful in some of their comments. And it just took one time of me standing up for myself, and then they were the nicest, sweetest person to me after that. And everyone's like, why are they so nice? And it's like, sometimes you got to think how many times they're actually made aware of what they're saying, and maybe they're not, sure. because people are afraid.
That's a great answer, actually. That's probably advice I can probably take, just given with my imposter syndrome most of the time.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm going to give myself a little bit of credit, you know, when we were chatting, we were doing a shift together, right?
Yeah.
Credit to all my happiness right now.
you told me about your story of, you know, all the internship, and you were telling me where you're living, and you're looking for, you know, your unicorn. And I was like, hey, I do a couple of relief shifts, like 10 minutes from, I think, from where you live. They're like the best hospital I ever worked with. You should hit them up. And you ended up signing with them.
I did. It was so serendipitous. And like, I think that was one of the things that also helped, is that when I got into this point of my career where I left, I was doing relief. I was trying to find my like place in my career and like, you know, life. I was trying to find my place. And then I ran into you again and was, you know, sharing the same things of what I'm looking for. And you had mentioned this hospital, and I'm like, I don't know, but okay. And I hadn't even looked at them because they didn't really match everything that I was looking for, because I was married to this idea of working with a criticalist, you know, coming from almost wanting to be one. I'm like, no, I need to have a criticalist, because that's like what my standard was for good emergency medicine for some reason. And I worked, I went and I visited the hospital, and they were just incredible. Their medicine's amazing. They're such a collaborative team. And yeah, they kind of won me over. It was nice because they did let me obviously do relief a couple more times to make sure I wasn't like just everyone was putting on a show, because I'm like, this isn't real. And then ended up signing with them. It was so serendipitous of just kind of letting go of where the reins were and seeing what kind of fell into my lap, and you know, doing relief and just going with the flow led to seeing you again and then connecting me with the place that I'm at now. So it's very cool.
So I recently went back over to that hospital, and I ran into the owner, and then, you know, of course I your name came up. And this is, I think, before you were officially started, but you had signed. And, you know, he was like, yeah, you know, she hard to really, she's a bit of an enigma, you know, you're a recent graduate. She's, you know, came in very confident, not cocky, but yet at the same time, you're like, there's this person, you know, again, not having any experience in the clinical sense as much as other people, you know, are they really, is she really backing up what she has here? And he said, yes. You know, he really spoke wonders about you. And everyone, of course, I know everyone at the hospital. So when I speak with them, again, everyone just reassures how much of a wonderful person you are to work with. So I'm happy.
Sweet of them. I'll pay them later.
I know. Now, so far, you mentioned that there's things that you acknowledge you still need to, skill sets that you need to gain. What are some of the ones that you've been focusing on more recently after almost a year?
Yeah, I think I'm getting into the point where I'm getting a lot more comfortable doing solo work, especially night shifts. Night shifts are, they take the best of me. They're actually the thing that I was going to say that I dislike right now at the moment, because I'm not a night owl. I don't think I could ever be that person that can see the bright side of night shift. But they're part of the work, they're part of the field, and you know, you have to do your time with it. So just, I think, gaining the organization skills in my brain and like confidence to manage the entire inpatient sort of list as well as the incoming ERs, because I'm a little bit of a perfectionist, which is a strange quality to have as an ER doctor. And it's sometimes a lot to manage, you know, the
Could
night
be dangerous.
Shift when you're alone. So, so kind of taking a couple steps back, giving myself some grace. And this is why this hospital has been amazing, is they're so supportive of night shift whenever anyone's on it, because they understand the work that goes into it, the responsibility, and that you're not going to probably figure out what's wrong with a very complicated case in the matter of your 12 hours that you have taken care of, however many patients are there and whatever is incoming. Just getting better with night shift is pretty much the thing I'm working on right now. And I haven't done a tracheostomy tube yet. Still waiting for that one patient.
Oh,
hopefully
okay.
Not, you know, don't want to put
the
it
next,
out there. But
the next Frenchie. That's fine. You'll get it. They got plenty.
Know, that's the big one that I haven't done, that, you know, just got to check off the list.
Oh, that'll be a good one.
And how many years have you been out? One, two?
One, less than one. June will be 1 year anniversary. Yeah.
I mean, if you do a trach at year one, that's
I know,
awesome.
Right?
Yeah. We'll see. I'll put the vibes out there. Yeah.
So you've mentioned balance, and of course we talked about financial stuff, which we don't really need to get too much into. With contracted work, you're obviously not working 80 to 90 hours a week like you were in your internship. So things are a lot more balanced in terms of the number of hours you're working. What are, you know, and this kind of dabbles into advice that you can give to other people, but what are your methods and what are the things that bring you peace and kind of help balance out your day-to-day life?
Yeah, I think balance was a huge part of the decision to kind of do what I did as well, because life doesn't stop while you're in vet school or even after. And I think the longer we put those things off to chase specialty training, it's incredible, and I support everyone that does it. But for me, the sacrifice was too much, and I really wanted to start living my life. So I had one of those like moments where I was like, epiphany, living in the present. I want to enjoy the time I have here with family. And
good for
so
you.
Yeah, and the financial aspect was a huge thing too, because obviously, you know, you go from vet school where you're pretty much living in debt and continuing to do so, and then you're just signing up for that debt to keep going up when you do these internships. And so I just was like, I'm done with that. So obviously, as soon as you start working in ER, it's a huge jump for entry salary. Probably regardless of where you end up on the spectrum, it's going from nothing to at least starting six figures in most places. Then yeah, your schedule is a lot better. Most places, relief, I pretty much made my schedule, so I could work really, really hard for a couple of weeks, a month, and then not work at all. And it was wonderful because I did this right at a time where it was the holiday season, so I got to spend Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's with my family, and take like 2, 3 weeks off almost, and then go back and work like 7 days in a row. It was great. It was great. And now working full time, the schedule's still fantastic. I work 14 days a month, a mixture of days, swings, and then 3 night shifts a month. And it's great. It lets me balance my work schedule with the things that also really enjoy. And my little hobbies that I can now like start to take in, which is fun. I've been reading, I've been going to the park with my dog, getting back into shape, which is great. And even doing like CE, which I found was one of the frustrating things about internship, was as much as it was hard work and lots of hours, and you're supposed to be doing CE and lectures, I felt like I wasn't retaining so much because of how little sleep I had and how much I was working. So now when I'm doing these like continuing education things on my own time, it's really settling in, and I have a lot more time to, look into cases and really dig deep with them, because I'm not overwhelmed with like I'm on 2 hours of sleep, but I have to do this again tomorrow.
Oh, that's great. Now, going into your hobbies, of course you have an easel right behind you. We just interviewed an artist who either her episode's either going to come before or after yours, and we got a whole scoop into art school and all that and fundamentals.
Wow.
What's your poison? Are you a watercolor? What do you do?
Oh, so I'm more of a watercolor and a sketcher, but I
Nice.
literally just did my first ever oil painting, and that was an adventure. I'm a very kind of just like learn as I go, figure
Oh,
it
yeah.
out. Painting is just a hobby. I don't take it as seriously as like it should, but it's just been a fun thing. And I actually made an oil painting for my boyfriend. It was supposed to be a Christmas present. It took like 3 extra months to be done. So he now got it like probably a couple weeks ago. But it was
Oh.
definitely an experience. I didn't realize oil paintings take so long to dry. They take forever to dry. It's probably
Oh,
still
yeah.
wet right now.
And the different
But I love
qualities of
water.
oils too, because you can get really cheap ones that don't blend well. And yeah, I've come across
It
that
was
stuff.
fun though. I enjoy it. It's my little, just sit there and to turn
Of
my
course.
phone off, listen to music. And
Awesome.
now I have enough time to read again, which is great, instead of reading textbooks. So it's been really
Yeah,
nice.
I hear books are coming back now. That's what everyone's reading,
Great.
actual cover books. Yeah.
Got my list of some up there.
Oh. Well, I'm so happy to hear about this, and just happy to see that you got such a great first year, and it looks like your second year is geared up to be even better. That's such a wonderful thing to see, a new graduate really have their wheels in order, on all aligned, and just putting their foot in the accelerator. I'm excited to see how things are going to be for you.
Thanks. No, this is awesome. And I think it's been interesting, as every time I've spoken to anyone where I was doing these relief, positions, I'd always get the same reaction, and it would be like, whoa, like how long are you out? And we get talking, and we kind of, and that's how I think we got talking, is just the fact that it is not a very well explored position for new grads, but it has so many benefits to finding the right fit for, a place out of school. But it also comes with the expectations of like you should know some things, because otherwise, you're in a position where you're doing the work of a full-time vet, most of the time unsupervised. So it does come with a burden of like a responsibility that you have to be willing to say you can or you can't do. So it was a unique thing that I kind of explored, and definitely was slightly stressful in the beginning, I will not lie. I
Yeah, I would bet.
the first few times showing up to these relief shifts, I was like, what if I don't know what I'm doing? What if something comes in and I don't know? So it was really nice to just establish like, is there somewhere there if I don't know what I'm doing, I can ask. and everyone was very supportive when I just communicated with them.
So would you say your biggest message with this whole ask, this whole experience, is that it's good to try to explore other hospitals, potentially via Relief, before initially signing with a hospital? Is that kind of
I think it's an option.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's an option for people that obviously, you know, internship, residency, match works a little different. But if you can get into a hospital at all to really see the dynamics and the support you would have in the culture, and if it would fit for what you're looking for before obviously signing or going to that internship, it'd be amazing. I think for your whole experience, because again, I was inundated with all these offers and it looked great, and people will tell you things on the phone that don't necessarily add up. And so even if 10 people mesh with one person, if they don't mesh with you, that can make that whole year working at that hospital really unfortunate. And so I know that's why most vet schools have that period where you can go do externships to be an extern at these hospitals and get your foot in the door, see if you like the people there, that you would go back for an internship or even a full-time job if it was offered. Those things are so really
6 weeks.
Yeah. So yeah. I think it's an option, and certainly something I'm happy to talk with people if they have more questions and they want to reach out. It's certainly not one that I think anyone has a rule book on. It's figured out perfect and it comes with its ups and downs. But if you haven't figured out what you want to do or where you want to end up when you graduate, I think it's an option before just signing any contract for like the security of just a position.
Which is awesome that our field has that. Because I think people are still trying to figure out, you know, how the time right after vet school really optimally used. And I think your experience is a testament to the fact that there's multiple routes people can take and it can work. So, no, that's awesome. And I think, I mean, I guess, sorry, I don't know how much time we have left, but I guess one thing I was wondering was that I mean, where did you feel like your preparation for being able to go into Relief so early? Mm-hmm. And was it like right at the start of vet school, did you feel like you were really trying to absorb info to be prepared right after graduation to be out? Or do you feel like you were in fourth year really trying to hammer ER, or like where was it?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I've actually thought about this because, you know, other students below me would always ask, because when I was at tech and I'd be training them, even they're like, you are definitely not what your typical fourth year vet student or new grad is at most of the time. And I think it was, I very much took full responsibility for my education, like from day one, geared it towards what was going to make me like graduate ready, which like, I feel like most of the time we're not 100% graduate ready when we do graduate, but I was so focused on learning all the skills that if I was put in a position to be a doctor as soon as I graduated, I'd feel like I could do 90% of the things that was required, or at least have the skills to figure it out. That was the big thing. It's like, I don't need to know everything, but I need to know how to figure it out. And I really focused that in vet school during clinics. UF has an awesome system where you go into clinics a little early and then you get a break and you go back into clinics.
Oh,
and
cool.
So I like stacked my rotational schedule with emergency rotations, all the electives, which could be a bad thing or not, but I pretty much dropped dermatology, I dropped Zoom Ed, and I put emergency critical care, emergency critical care, you know, don't see too many derm emergencies.
What are you going to do with a turtle with the rash comes in? You're screwed.
Okay. So, and that just gave me time with the professors and the instructors enough to the point where when they had these complicated procedures that most residents were doing, they would let me do. So I got to graduate vet school doing pericardiocentesis, chest taps, central lines, chest tubes. I'd done like a lot of things that most ER vets, I think, don't even get to do until they're already in their first year of like working.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing I didn't get to do was obviously a tracheotomy. So it's been really nice because now I've done all those things again and a couple more times, but it wasn't as scary doing it for the first time because I got to do it in vet school. But I had to ask, and I know none of those opportunities would have come if I had sat there waiting for these, professors or residents to be like, oh, here, do this. I very much made sure that I knew how to do it verbally. I'd seen videos, so when the opportunity came, I could ask, can I do this? And most of the time, I had like proven myself where the resident was like, sure.
So you had definitely a very unique situation where you knew essentially what you wanted to do. And of course, with your great and direct personality, you were able to kind of put yourself personally in the situation to gain those skills while in vet school.
Yeah.
You know, because of maybe some situations with other vet students, and maybe one, they don't know what they want to do yet, or two, they might be a little more shy about asking for it. If we're trying to get these new graduates into an early relief situation, I guess what I'm saying is I've noticed that people will do internships, rotating internships, to kind of get that high level of experience in a short term, and then they go into relief.
Yeah.
Is that, what are your thoughts on that?
I support internships. I think they're great, especially for those that didn't get all the experience during vet school, were still figuring out which realm they wanted to take, and then missed out on maybe stacking their rotations with emergency and critical care. So I think internships are a fantastic program to really put you into being a doctor with mentorship, with support, knowing that like people are watching over you. Now, the caveat to that is that not all internships are created equal.
Yeah.
So do your research, visit them, talk to people that have done them in the past, because not all internships are going to offer you all the support, especially on the ER rotation. Sometimes the ER rotation is the rotation where you are sink or swim. So just do your research into the internship program itself, because there's a lot of them that are amazing, and there's some that, we're cheap labor.
Absolutely. Yeah,
it's true.
All right, guys. Well, let's move on to the OMA sarcoma. All right.
Sounds good.
All right. Good. All right. Here's Taylor, since Taylor's the guest, she can get started and we can always circle back. Because mine's kind of
remind me, what is it?
So unprepared.
I know.
I okay,
stole
I'm
this.
Usually unprepared.
Yeah. I this is like the first or second time I'm prepared for this. But I stole this from Eliza Schleisinger. She's a famous comedian. She has a podcast where it's called Top of the Cob, where the top of the cob is the most delicious part of your cobbler and the bottom part is not as good. So you list something that is very positive, something that you're very happy about, right? It could be your new shirt. It could be, you got a new job, anything that's positive, which is typically like an OMA. So your tumors that are OMA are usually benign, and your sarcomas are usually kind of the bad, more malignant type. So that's more of the bad part of what's going through your mind right now. So it could be you stepped your toe, your car broke down or anything like that. It could be politics. I think someone talked about the depression. No, what is it? Capitalism was crippling. Capitalism was the last one that we had. So, if you're not ready, I can go through mine, and then we can circle back to you.
Sure. Let's
okay. Remy, I know we have a shared document that I wrote, but I have a different one. So, and it's connected.
Switching
but
it up
I'll,
on us.
Yeah, I'll come back to the sarcoma, even though it's tied in. My OMA is last night. Mika, I believe, said her first words.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Or you have convinced it? Yourself.
It I have it. I have
was
it on
dad
recording.
Or mom?
I have it on a recording. And so I'll go back. All right. So I guess I'll say my sarcoma.
Oh, wait. What was the word?
Oh, it was you, mama.
It was mama.
Sarcoma. Yeah. Oh. Which is fine. Which is totally fine because Pam was at work. And so I was putting her to bed. And so normally she'll feed off the breast to then go to bed, but then we had the cup with the straw, which she's been great at and she was drinking out of, but it's really always been Pam putting her to sleep just because it's just, well, at least for the last few months. So she's developed a routine of it. So I was in there and the first thing is, it's like, it's not just like mumbling maws and like, ma, ma. It was like, mama, like straight up. And so when Pam came back from work, I went to the store, so I got a couple of treats and like, here's surprise number one, here's surprise number two. And I was like, are you ready for surprise number three? And I played the recording and we both just like teared up and like just, you know, listened to the recording because obviously it's, you know, it's a milestone to see.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I don't know if it's not really repeatable, but I would count this as a first word. I know it's a little early, but it was so distinct. She'll mumble like da, 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 da sometimes, but I don't really count that. So
I remember Pam asked, she was just like, does that count as the first word if it's like not just two, it's repeated over and over? Like,
I didn't think it counted.
Sounds like Mama won it. So
we have higher standards than that. And I need
I almost prefer it because Pam puts so much pressure on herself as a mother. And I mean, I think I do a good job and I put a lot of effort and heart into it, but she, you know, she really takes on this role as like an absolute primary parent. And you see all these videos. I don't know if you guys have the algorithm in your feed, but you know, a lot of mothers will complain how she puts all this time gestating and doing all this stuff and feeding, and then the first word of a kid's mouth is dada, and you know, here we are barely. So I'm happy that she was able to get this as the first word. So
no, that's so sweet. Yeah.
All right, guys, top that.
Damn.
No, I don't know if I could do that. Yeah. I can. Yeah. So we all do omas first, and then we all do sarcomas after.
I guess at this point.
Sarcoma was mama. Okay, yeah. You just flipped it. Got it.
So you guys just do both.
So I, you know, I'm really just living my best life right now. My oma is just. The risk that I took has finally come with the reward, which is me being really, really happy, loving my new job. You know, 2 months in now, no, 3 months. I'm almost at my 3 months. Yeah. So it's been great. My sarcoma right now, though, is despite living my best life right now, I have a raccoon living in my attic. No, it has been like a 2 week ordeal trying to get the raccoon out. And I'm an animal lover and I really think raccoons are sweet and cute, but I am starting to dislike them more and more. We have literally turned this into, I was almost going to start blogging about it. We have like cameras set up and everything, and we hear her and she'll leave and then she'll come back in and we'll like get notifications on the camera. And we've tried to patch up the place and we were like successful the other day and like celebrating saying goodbye raccoon, and she freaking destroyed it and got back in the attic the other day. So we're on week two of trying to evict our raccoon from the attic. So she is my sarcoma right now. We've named her Gloria.
Okay. You know, it's a female.
So the people that were having help us think that it's a female because and she may be pregnant or may have even given birth in our attic.
Which so would make sense why no she tries so hard to go back in there. Whoa.
Broken.
Okay. Oh, that's terrible. I'm sorry.
Yes. Watch this space. We'll see. I'll put an update on my Instagram.
Okay. Yeah, we need updates.
Please do.
I guess for mine, my oma is that I went paddleboarding, which we do that pretty often. But, you know, in Florida, it gets a little bit cold. So you got to wait for it to warm up. So
like a whole 60, so 70 cold.
Degree cold. A whole 5 degrees. Yeah. So now it's back to paddleboard weather. So it's actually perfect, honestly, because the water is like colder. Mm-hmm. It offsets the heat of the air. So it was a good time. It was chill. We have a place that we go to frequently, and Lacey and Joe visited, but we didn't have a chance to like go paddleboarding because they didn't have enough days here. But in the future,
Lacey and Joe are one of our CSU friends.
They're
nice
in our circle of friends. But the sarcoma is I am tired, like really tired. And the problem is that I'm very much a night person, just in terms of like my optimal level of focus and just like my productivity for like getting work done is usually like midnight to 4 a.m. is like a peak time for me. But obviously that's like not crazy. Conducive to anything else in life. But the problem is like, you know, when I need to flip my schedule, I will. But there's always the debate, like, which way do you go? Do you go backwards or do you go forwards? And I'm sure it's like ER docs, you guys get it. And my chosen strategy is usually to just stay up as long as possible, right? So usually if you're used to going to bed at like 7, you just try to go all the way until like 4 or 5, right?
And it always sounds like a good plan.
Yeah, well, it's just like by noon, you're like, oh, and it's miserable. But I tried the other way, so I went backwards this time. And I'd say overall, I'm gonna rate that lower. So, if I had to give some tips, yeah, I would say staying up longer works better. So
just wait for spirit the whole time.
Yeah, good to just know. Power through it.
Well, yeah. I'm glad you're able to get some paddleboard. Yeah. Got some exercise in. So.
Yeah, got some paddleboard.
That's good.
I don't know if I'd count that as true exercise.
I think it's a workout for sure. Yeah. Don't discredit that.
Barely.
Yeah, and you got some sun finally. So.
No, you wear one of those little sun shirts with the hoodies. It's like this, but
dude, forever
pale. I sunburn so easily. So no, I get my 5 minutes of sun and I'm done. But yeah, otherwise it was good.
All right, good, man.
But, awesome.
Yeah, right, thanks guys. For coming on the podcast. Yeah.
No, thanks for awesome. Having me.
I'm really impressed with, I didn't know someone could go into relief right after graduating, but
obviously well, hopefully I haven't peaked and that was like the most interesting thing about my career so far. I truly think there's
on that story for decades.
I think this is going to go well for you. So I'm really excited for you.
Thank you. Thanks for talking to me now. I'm here as well.
Of course, guys.
Yeah, good luck.
All right, everybody. Yeah. Good luck with the raccoon.
With the new
and
job.
Your overnights.
Thanks.
All right, guys. We will catch you later.
Have a good one.
Bye.